Okay, grab your Bibles and go to Acts chapter 23, and that's where we will be spending these two chapters, chapters 23 and 24. We'll be looking at those two chapters this morning, and just by way of review, so that we know what's happening when we get to Acts chapter 23, we are looking at the last of this book. Really, starting in about chapter 21, there's 28 chapters in the book. Starting about chapter 21 through the end of the book, we are reading about Paul's imprisonment. Although this takes a while for him to get to the city of Rome, that's eventually where he is going to end up when we get to chapter 28. But Paul finished his third missionary journey in Acts chapter 21. He finished it in the city of Jerusalem, and on that occasion, he was arrested there in Jerusalem. And what we are reading about are the proceedings that followed that arrest. And he was treated very cruelly for an innocent man to begin with, treated very cruelly for a Roman citizen, which would have been illegal during that day to beat him and to treat him in the way that they did without any justification for it. When you get to chapter 23, Paul has been brought before the Jewish Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin was kind of like the Jewish Supreme Court. They had about 70 members of the Sanhedrin who would sit and listen to cases that were brought before them. They usually sat in like a semicircle so that the accused could be placed right in the middle, and have all of those eyes looking down on him. On this occasion in chapter 23, the Sanhedrin had been called together, not of their own volition, but they had been called together by the local Roman commander. And the reason he brought them together was for them to deal with Paul and to try to figure out, what is this guy's deal? Why is he causing all of these problems? Of course, Paul wasn't causing any problems. He was just being accused of these things without any kind of evidence. And we saw 2 weeks ago about the first five verses of chapter 23 and how Paul appeared before the Sanhedrin, and he told them in chapter 23 and verse 1 that he had lived before God in all good conscience even up until that day. And on that occasion the high priest had Paul struck. And, of course, Paul said he didn't recognize even the high priest as God's high priest. He was not sitting in a role that God would be pleased with. So Paul's standing before the Sanhedrin. Go to chapter 23, verse 6, and that's kind of where we're going to pick up in a study this morning. The Sanhedrin was made up of Jews, but as you know, there were a number of different Jewish sects, S-E-C-T-S, different divisions, groups of the Jews. They were made up of the Pharisees, and the Sadducees would be the two that we would readily recognize their names. And the Sadducees were kind of the leaders of the Sanhedrin. They were usually the majority group, and the high priest himself was usually a Sadducee. And so Paul, in chapter 23, verse 6, looks at the Sanhedrin, knows that they are divided. They're all Jews, but they're divided religiously between the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And so he says in verse 6, "I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee." Well, they all knew that. That was his background. But then he says, "Concerning the hope and resurrection of the dead, I am being judged." Go back for just a second. Look in chapter 22, verse 21. Look in chapter 22, verse 21. When Paul was addressing the mob in Jerusalem after he had been arrested, as soon as he says in chapter 22, verse 21, that he was going to the Gentiles, the very mention of the name Gentiles sent the Jews into a frenzy. They went crazy when they heard the word Gentiles. Well, come to chapter 23. Chapter 23 and verse 6, when the Sadducees heard the word resurrection, there were some buzzwords for these people back then. Gentiles would have been one of them. for the Sadducees, any mention of the resurrection was just going to send them into a frenzy. Paul knew that. This wasn't a surprise to him. And so he said, for the hope of the resurrection, that's why I'm being judged. And when he had said this, verse 7 says, a dissension arose between the Pharisees and Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. If Paul wanted to stop the proceedings, this was the way to do it. Because this got everybody, their attention is now off of Paul, and it's now turned towards each other. Here's a verse for us to know in verse 8. It's the background bit of the Sadducees. For the Sadducees say that there is no resurrection. How miserable of people do you have to be to believe there is no resurrection? That's why they're sad. They're sad, you see, because they don't believe that there's anything after the resurrection. They believe that once you're dead, you're like Rover and you're dead all over. And then after that, it doesn't matter. And so here's some individuals who are materialists in that regard. They don't believe in the resurrection. They don't believe in angels or spirits. These are just sad people all around. And you think, well, how could they sit on the same court as the Pharisees? Because what does the end of verse 8 say? The Pharisees confess both. Here are some people that believe some very different things. This isn't just some minor issue. This is something that has to do with preparation for the hereafter. And there's great dissension between these two groups. And so verse 7 says there was a dissension. The end of the verse said that there was division. Verse 9 says, then there arose a loud outcry. When loud outcry is gets it just about right, this was the Greek word here is the sound, is the Greek word krauge, which is what a raven, it's the sound that a raven would make when a raven was crowing or crying. That's what they're doing. These people are out of control. The scribes of the Pharisees' party arose and they protested. Get this scene. There's dissension, division. There's loud outcries. Now the scribes stand up and they begin to protest. They're ready to defend their position. And they say, we find no evil in this man. Well, I don't know that they meant that as a whole, but in regard to the resurrection, they're on the same page. We find no evil in this man. But if a spirit or an angel has spoken to him, think about this statement, let us not fight against God. You know, if they had had the mentality, let us not fight against God, they wouldn't have been sitting there with Paul on trial to begin with. But they were fighting against God. So verse 10 says, now there arose a great dissension. Verse 7 says there was a dissension. Now there is a great dissension. So much so that the Roman commander Lysias, fearing that Paul might be pulled to pieces. Get the scene. This isn't just a little spat between some unhappy Jews. This is a violent scene. And the Roman commander thought these Jews are going to pull this guy apart. And so he sent his soldiers in, took him by force, and brought him into the barracks. So far, Paul has been arrested. Paul has been beaten prior to this time. He had been, he had been interrogated and questioned under interrogation, some kind of torture methods perhaps used on Paul. They found out at the end of chapter 22 that he was a Roman citizen. And so Lysias called that off. He's brought before the Sanhedrin. The high priest has Paul struck across his mouth. And now he's about ready to be pulled into pieces. If you're Paul, what's going through your mind? If you're Paul, you've arrived in Jerusalem. You have been there for less than a week. Okay, get this picture. He's there. He's actually there probably about 5 days at this point. And all of this, I just got here. Are you kidding me? You know, I just arrived. How is all of this? They are in such violent uproar against him, and he's there only about 5 days. So he's taken into Gentile custody, which is what Agabus the prophet said was going to happen. If you were Paul, how much would verse 11 mean to you? If you were Paul, you had just been taken violently, or forcefully anyway, back into Gentile custody, into the Roman barracks there at the temple compound. The following night, the Lord, what does it say? The Lord stood by him. Does it say that the Lord appeared to stand by him? It was an image. Does it say that the ghost of the Lord stood by him? Who's there next to Paul? It says the Lord was there. The Lord stood by him. Now, this is not the occasion in 2 Timothy chapter 4 when Paul said, "All men forsook me, but the Lord stood by me." That's later on. And so we have at least two occasions. This one, coupled with 2 Timothy chapter 4, about verses 17 and 18, at least two occasions where Paul says, "The Lord stood with me." What did the Lord say to him in verse 11? "Be of good cheer." Really? Okay, they've beaten me. I am wounded and sore. They about pulled me to pieces, and now I'm here in Gentile custody. Paul, cheer up. Be of good courage. If you're Paul, what are you thinking? Now, was that a strange thing for Jesus to say? When Jesus came walking to his disciples on the water and they were fearful because of the storm and they thought he was a ghost, what did he say to them? Be of good cheer. When Jesus appeared in the upper room after his resurrection and the disciples are fretful because of the events of the last 3 days and he appears unto them, be of good cheer. Peace unto you. Does God say anything like that to us? Not verbally, not that he stand next to you while you were shaving this morning and tell that to you, but does God say anything like that to us? Be of good cheer. So you say, rejoice in the Lord always, and again I say rejoice. Does he say, be anxious for nothing? Has he ever said that to you? Well, every time you read Philippians 4 and verse 6, he says that to you. Be anxious for nothing. What does he say? Be of good cheer, Paul. For as you have testified of me in Jerusalem, so you must also bear witness at Rome. What's he telling him? Nothing's going to happen to you here. You are not going to die in Jerusalem. You are at least going to make it as far as Rome. You've got to get to Rome to testify to me of me in Rome. Would that be of encouragement to Paul? Perhaps he didn't know what was going to happen to him in Jerusalem. And what did the Lord just say? You're good. I've got you covered. I've got your back. Nothing's going to happen to you. You think that gave Paul boldness? You think he stepped out the next day, "Okay, guys, give me your best shot. My God just told me nothing's happening to me here, so bring it on." Verse 12. We read about a conspiracy, and I probably missed you on this slide. We're not going to talk about tradition, but that's on the back of your handout. I filled in a lot of these blanks for you last night because I knew we wouldn't have time to fill in blanks. But Roman numeral number 2, letter B on the back of your handout for chapter 23. That's the blank for tradition. When you get to verse 12, we read about a conspiracy. Over 40 men conspire together that they will not eat or drink until Paul is dead. I want you to think about would you get involved in a scheme like that? Okay, guys, how about you? I won't eat or drink anything until Paul's dead. Or what are we talking about, 30 minutes? I mean, are we talking about 45 minutes? I'm not going to, are you going to give your stomach that long? In other words, in their mind, somebody's going to die. When they take an oath, this is an oath to the death. This isn't just a, you know, rock, paper, scissors. Oh, okay, well, okay, we'll take this and see how far it goes. This was an oath until death. Somebody's going to die. Either they're going to die of starvation, right? Or Paul's going to die. How How twisted do these people have to be? This is one guy. It's one guy. One man, and they have their world wrapped around him. They have their lives wrapped. They're willing to give their own lives for him. We won't eat or drink until he's dead. Verse 12 says that they banded together in an oath to kill Paul. Verse 13 calls it a conspiracy. They swore together that they would do this, that they would kill Paul. They sent a message in verse 14 to the chief priest and the elders, and they let their scheme be known. And basically they said to the chief priest and elders, verses 14 and 15, listen, send down to Lysias the commander. Have him bring Paul out. And when he brings Paul out, we'll kill him. Okay, sounds good to us. Verse 16 is interesting. So when Paul's sister's son heard of their ambush. Did you know Paul had a sister? Now we do. Did you know that Paul's sister had a son? What's his name? What's his sister's name? Where were we told of Paul's family tree? Where were we told of his siblings? It's interesting that we're not told anything about Paul in this regard. You know, which is, as you begin to look for evidences of the inspiration of the Bible, if a human was writing this, would he just leave it to that? Paul's sister's son. Wait a minute. What's her name? What's his name? Where'd they come from? Where have they been? Is he a Christian? Was he converted? Was she converted? What does the nephew care about his uncle? Maybe this is old Uncle Paul. He's just crazy anyway, right? I mean, what's their relationship? If a human was writing this, we'd have a whole lot more information we don't need. God gave us the information that we do need. Sister's son heard about the ambush. Okay, so what? Is he under obligation to do something? Could this have been the providence of God at work? How did he hear about it? Where was he that he heard about this conspiracy? Is this the providence of God that maybe he's at the right place at the right time and he hears about it? But just because he heard about it, does that make any difference? I mean, this is a conspiracy to kill Uncle Paul. If I get myself involved, what might happen to me? I don't know. Maybe I'll keep my nose out of it. He went, verse 16, and entered the barracks and told Paul. It's interesting how matter of fact it says that. How does he get into the Roman barracks? How does a Jew make his way in at like it's just, oh, hello, I'm here to see Paul. Oh, okay, come right on in. He enters the Roman barracks and he tells Paul. Now, if you want to see providence at work, he not only heard about it, he not only told Paul. Paul calls in verse 17 one of the Roman centurions and he says, take this man to the commander Lysias, for he has something to tell him. Why would the centurion listen to Paul? What? Okay, crazy Paul. Yeah, just go back to your cell. We're going to go back to our card game. You know, we'll get you some more medicine. Just sit down and be quiet. I mean, why would he listen to Paul? And why would he do anything that Paul would ask him to do? Huh? Well, he's a Roman citizen. He has rights. But why take this boy, and we think it's a boy, why take this young man to go to the commander? Okay, so the centurion takes him to the commander. In verse 18, he says to the commander, Paul the prisoner, that's how he's described, Paul the prisoner wanted me to bring this guy to you because he's got something to say to you. Why would the commander care about this? Notice what the commander does in verse 19. Takes him, he goes inside, takes him aside by himself, and he speaks to him privately. There is a degree of interest here. And so the nephew tells him about the plot to kill Paul. There's more than 40 men, verse 21, lying in wait to have him killed. So the commander, verse 22, the commander let the young man depart. And he commanded him, don't tell anybody you've revealed these things to me. I don't know if that's the providence of God at work or not. What did God say in verse 11 to Paul? Paul, nothing's going to happen to you here. Okay, God, how are you going to work that out? Paul's in Roman custody. How's that going to work out? And here's a conspiracy that the nephew hears, that the nephew reveals, and now the commander, is going to act upon the information that he has received. And so on Roman numeral number one, what is that, letter C, on the back of your first handout, notice the degree, notice how many individuals are involved, how many soldiers are involved. Look at verse 23. The Roman commander on site there at the temple, he called for two centurions. Okay, you call for two centurions. What's that usually going to get you? You're going to get two centurions, and you're going to get 200 guys, 200 soldiers. He called two centurions, and he said, prepare 200 soldiers. It's just little old Paul. I mean, are you serious? 200 guys? No, not serious. That's not enough. 200 soldiers, verse 23, plus 70 horsemen. Get my cavalry out there, and 200 spearmen, and get him ready to go to Caesarea. 470 guys to transport one preacher. Hello. A troublesome preacher requires 470 guys? Well, I don't know that the commander was so much concerned about Paul causing trouble as he was whatever trouble was going to be brought upon Paul. If there were over 40 guys who were willing to die to kill Paul, what else are they going to face? So I want you to picture this. 470 soldiers at 9 o'clock at night, the third hour of the night, verse 23 says, and they leave town, transporting Paul. Done? Yeah. He has charge of a prisoner. And so his own life is on the line. It's amazing. And maybe this was typical, or maybe this was atypical. We don't know. 470 armed guys to transport one guy by night, which would have been unusual to begin with. But he wants to be under cover of darkness. He sends Paul out, verse 24, and this is the first time we read about Felix. He sent him to go to Felix, the governor of Judea. When Jesus was on trial, what was the name of the governor before whom Jesus appeared? Pilate. Pilate was in this same position. Pilate was the governor of Judea, the proconsul of Judea, in the same position that Felix was. If you go and look at a succession, historical succession of the procurators, the governors of Judea, you'll have Pilate at around the time of Jesus' death, and then you're going to come down and you're going to see Felix on that list too. So basically, Paul is going to appear before the same person that Jesus appeared before. Except in Jesus' case, Pilate was in Jerusalem, and on this time, Felix was back at his mansion. Felix was back at his place over in Caesarea, which was kind of the headquarters, the Roman headquarters in that area anyway. And so Lysias sends a letter to Felix to explain to him this particular prisoner transfer. And for the most part, the letter is mostly factual. Of course, Felix is presenting himself to be the wonderful Felix who saved the day. Look in verse 27. He writes this letter. This man was seized by the Jews and was about to be killed by them. And so I came and rescued him. I want you, and so go through that verse 27 through 30 and look at how many times you're going to see the word I or the word me. This is all about Lysias, but This was the occasion before he even knew he was a Roman, is what he's describing. He was seized by the Jews, about to be killed by them. Coming with the troops, I rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman. No, that's not exactly the details. You go back to chapter 22, and Lysias was involved in beating him. Oh, until he found out he was a Roman. But he left that part out of the letter. He didn't want to get wordy, I think. Verse 28, and when I wanted to know the reason they accused him, I brought him before their council, the Jewish Sanhedrin. I found out that he was accused concerning questions of their law, which is totally interesting. This was a Jewish religious matter. And who is Paul being sent to? A Roman judge, the Roman governor. They're making a civil case out of a religious issue. That sound familiar? That wouldn't happen today, would it? Civil case out of a religious issue. So he said in verse 29, but they had nothing charged against him deserving of death or chains. When it was told to me that the Jews lay in wait for the man, I sent him immediately to you, and I commanded that his accusers come there as well. So verse 31, the soldiers, as they were commanded, they took Paul. They brought him to Felix. They went halfway. They got to Antipatris, which was about 35 miles out. And at that point, the 200 soldiers and the 200 spearmen, they returned, went back to Jerusalem. And the cavalry, at the end of verse 32, or the beginning of verse 32, the cavalry, those 70 horsemen, continued on their way to Caesarea and presented Paul there. And in the end of chapter 23, Felix decided to wait. He said in verse 35, I will hear you when your accusers have come. And he commanded that that Paul be kept in Herod's praetorium. Herod the Great had built a palace in Caesarea. And the historians say that it was 165 acres in size. How big is your palace? Is your palace 165 acres in size? That's where Paul was escorted, is to the praetorium, the prison part of this, and that's where he was going to be kept for 5 days. We're going to get in chapter 24 here in a minute. Anybody have any comments? We've kind of run through a lot of that. But think about what Paul's going through. Think about being transported by these Roman soldiers and what's going through his mind. Johnny? Well, that's interesting. That's a great question. What happened to the 40 guys? Those guys, the group of over 40 guys said, we won't eat or drink until Paul is dead. Guess what, guys? Paul's still alive. You know, read through the rest of the book. He's still alive. And so if they were true to their oath, they died. How foolish do you have to be? But if they were true to their oath, those men died because Paul didn't. Richard? In chapter 24, it could be. They could have been a part of the group in chapter 24. In chapter 24, Paul is brought before Felix. Now look at verse 1. And here's how we said earlier that Paul had endured all of that in less than a week. What do you learn in verse 20 in chapter 24 and verse 1 that after 5 days Paul is brought before them. Drop down to verse, just to put this in context, look in verse 11. Chapter 24, verse 11, when Paul is making his defense, he says that it is present tense, not past tense, up to the point where he is today, it is no more than 12 days since I went up to Jerusalem. So tie that back in. Paul finishes his first missionary journey. Chapter 21, verse 17. You get to chapter 24 and verse 11, and Paul says, it's only been 12 days since I got to Jerusalem. Now, chapter 24, verse 1 says that Paul was in prison in Caesarea for 5 days before his accusers got there. It took him 2 days to get to Caesarea, 1 day to get to Antipatris, and then the second day to get to Caesarea. So there you got 7 days. So Paul had only been in Jerusalem for no more than 5 days when all of this other stuff was transpiring. So come to chapter 24. Paul is brought before Felix because now his supposed accusers have arrived. Ananias, who was the high priest at the time, the one who had Paul struck, the one who Paul said, I don't recognize this guy as God's high priest, came down with the elders. Is it possible that the 40 men were with them? It doesn't indicate. There are accusers that have come down, but what we're going to see about these accusers is that they don't have any evidence to be brought before them. They brought down in verse 1, they brought, I think the New American Standard calls him, their attorney. They brought their lawyer. I mean, that's what you would have done, right? They brought Ananias, they brought the elders, and they brought Tertullus, their attorney, who may have been their legal advisor in Roman affairs to begin with. No doubt the Jews would have had such a person to kind of handle their matters before Roman officials. And so they gave evidence, supposedly, the end of verse 1 says, to the governor against Paul. So Tertullus stands up in verse 2, begins his accusation. The first thing he does is to butter up Felix. And basically lie to him. That's the best way to butter somebody up, right? They basically lied to him. He almost, if you were to read verses 2, 3, and 4 of chapter 24, you would think that the Jews and Felix had a lovely relationship. You read history, and they had anything but. The Jews hated Felix. He treated them horribly. He was responsible for a high priest named Jonathan. After Ananias was high priest, they had a high priest named Jonathan, and Felix was responsible for having him put to death. He was a cruel leader, and yet Tertullus makes it sound like he's just Mr. Wonderful, seeing that though we enjoy great peace, no you don't, but we do, that you enjoy great peace and prosperity is being brought to this nation by your wonderful foresight. We just love you so much. No, they didn't. We accepted all. No, they don't accept it either. They rebelled against it. But, you know, for these purposes, we accept it always and in all places, most noble Felix. And we do it with thankfulness. You're killing us, but we're thankful. You're beating us silly, but we're thankful. No, you know, look at how ridiculous he's making it sound. Nevertheless, you know, I don't want to waste your time, verse 4. So he says, verse 5, we have found this man. Look at how he describes Paul. We have found this man a plague. The American Standard call him a pestilent man. I think New American Standard just calls him a pest. That's not a nice thing to say. He's a plague. He's a pest. He is a creator of dissension. Wait a minute. What in Jerusalem, what dissension did Paul create? What dissension was he responsible for creating? He created dissension among all the Jews throughout the whole world. Really? And number 3 in verse 5, he is a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. He's the guy who's in charge of all this happening. He even tried in verse 6, he even tried to profane the temple. By the way, they changed their story on that. When they first arrested him, they said he has profaned the temple. It was something he had done. Now they're just saying, oh, he tried to do it. Have you ever done that? Start backpedaling on a story? That's what they're doing. He even tried to profane the temple. That's not what they said before. And we seized him and wanted to judge him according to our law. Drop down to verse 8. They tell Felix, look, you examine him. You'll be able to ascertain all these things that we accuse him of. They leave it with Felix. That's their presentation of their case. That's a pretty weak case. The case is, we don't like him. He's not a nice guy. He was mean and did these. Okay, where's your evidence? And so that's what Paul does in verse 10. Paul begins to defend himself before Felix, and to show that these guys have absolutely no credibility, no evidence at all. I don't think you have any blanks on the back of this handout, so I'm going to just skip through some of that. But in Roman numeral number 1, letter B, on your lesson 30 for chapter 24, Paul makes his defense before Felix. And notice how he says he does it in verse 10. I know you've been a judge of this nation for many years. I'm standing before you and I'm making my defense cheerfully. Could you say that? If you were on trial, would you say, I'm here cheerfully to make my answer, my defense before you? So first he tells them, these guys have absolutely no evidence. He says, go ahead, ascertain what you want. But it's only been 12 days since I came to Jerusalem. How much time have I had to stir up all the trouble that they're accusing me of? I was only in Jerusalem for 5 days. And it sounds like, you know, I've created a war. Verse 12, they neither found me in the temple disputing with anyone nor inciting the crowd. And they didn't find me in the temple, in the synagogues, or in the city. They are accusing me of inciting dissension and a riot. And he says, but they don't have any evidence. They didn't find me doing any of that. But he says to them in verse 14, let me tell you about myself. They're accusing me of all of this. Let me tell you about me. What I'm concerned about is my relationship with God. Here's what I confess to you. That according to the way, the way of Christianity, frequently called that as we've seen it, they call the way a sect. Christianity is not a sect, but they call it that. But according to the way of God, I worship the God. And three times you're going to see the word God in here. I worship the God of my fathers. Because I believe all things which are written in the law and the prophets. Paul was preaching the resurrection of Christ. And what did he just tell Felix? I'm preaching what's written in the law and the prophets. These Jews should have known about this. It's in their own law. Verse 15, he says, I not only worship God. Verse 15, he says, my hope is in God. I have hope in God. I know there's going to be a resurrection of the dead. And the back of your handout has a section on the resurrection. Paul here says, I know there's going to be a resurrection of the dead, both of the just and the unjust. At the end of time, there's going to be one resurrection, not two. Millennialists want us to believe, premillennialists want us to believe that there's going to be two resurrections separated by 1,000 years. And God doesn't teach this. Verse 16, he not only says, I worship God in verse 14, my hope is in God in verse 15, but he says, I live before God in all good conscience in verse 16. And so he just summarizes for him in verse 17, and I think you've got this on your handout down at the end of page 1, the summary, letter B, number 4, where he summarizes the facts. He came to Jerusalem with a benevolent purpose. He was purified there. He wasn't creating a mob. The actual people who saw him apparently in the temple, didn't come to Caesarea. So the guys who are there have absolutely no evidence. And he wants them to know, the end of verse 21, concerning the resurrection of the dead, that's why he's being judged. He wanted Felix to recognize this was not a civil matter. This is a matter of what he was teaching on a religious thing called the resurrection. Dan? About 20. Dan asked how many years between Acts 9 when he's converted, and now it's about 20 years. That were, yeah, could have been. Sure, sure. Dan says some of these same people could have been the ones who were complicit in the things against Jesus, and very well could have been. These were determined individuals to do everything they could to destroy Jesus, to destroy Christianity and the message that's being proclaimed, and they were going to stop at nothing. Truth didn't matter to them. Evidence didn't matter to them. Having an actual case didn't matter to them. And did it matter with them with Jesus? They didn't have any truth or evidence or anything against Jesus, and yet they created a riot as they were doing here. Here's what we know Felix for. Here's what we know Felix for, is at the end of chapter 24, in verse 22, he basically deferred the matter. Paul's innocent, but I'm not going to do anything about it. I'll just put it off. He would not have Paul released at all. In verse 24, He comes with his wife Drusilla. That's an interesting story about Felix and Drusilla and how he got Drusilla to be his wife. Deception and seduced her away from her husband before. Anyway, they come before him. And what does Paul do in verse 25? He reasoned about righteousness. Felix doesn't want to hear about that. Self-control. Felix doesn't want to hear about that. And the judgment to come. So Paul the preacher gave him a message he wanted to hear, right? He watered it down for him. No, he laid it out. Verse 25 says that Felix was afraid. And here's what we know Felix for. Go away for now. When I have a convenient time, I will call for you. He heard the gospel. He said, oh, when it's a convenient season, I'll call for you. But to our knowledge, he never made any changes. There's no such thing as a more convenient season to obey the gospel than right now. So anyway, Felix keeps Paul in prison for 2 years. The end of the chapter, Paul remains in Caesarea in prison for 2 years. And then next week, we're going to pick up with chapter 25 with what happens with Paul after that two-year period. Tried to cover a lot today. I know there wasn't a whole lot of time for discussion, but thank you for your attention and for following through on this study this morning.